Hello, Candace. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm great, Shane. How are you?
I'm also good, thank you. We have a very interesting topic lined up for today. You know, you're a naturopathic doctor and you work in all sorts of healing fields and, you know, different modalities. And we're here today to talk about some of those things and, you know, what it means to sort of look at the body as a self-healing mechanism and how that sort of relates to disease and conditions and, you know, what all that stuff means. And beyond that, we're also going to incorporate some elements of spirituality and energy medicine to really just get a broader understanding of this field of work, which is very fascinating to me. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here.
So how about we just start off with a little bit about you? What sort of got you into this field? How did you end up here?
You know, I want to say it was the turning point in my life because I was just had finished a performance review. I was working in oil and gas in Calgary, and my manager kind of said, either you get a designation or you're not getting promoted. And I thought, well, not getting promoted is not going to work for me. So I guess I better figure out what designation I'm going to get.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, at the time, I was in finance, internal audit to be specific. So I had looked at some of those, but nothing really ignited me. And I probably spent about 6 months searching all kinds of degrees, master's programs, and somehow circled back to naturopathic medicine. I remember actually being in tears when I saw the principles of naturopathic medicine, thinking to myself, I already live like this. Like, how beautiful would it be to share this with other people?
Hmm. And what was it about those principles that, you know, resonated so deeply with you?
Yeah, it was treating the whole person. That was one of the elements. Whole foods diet was another principle. The activating the healing power within, which we call the VIS. So activating that inner guy, like the inner system for the healing and just all of that kind of encompassed in one place.
No, it's true. And it's quite a difference to the sort of traditional medicine that we usually see, you know, and it's not that it doesn't have its place. Of course, you know, things can work in harmony together, like surgery mm-hmm. and all those kinds of things are pretty important as well.
Absolutely.
But it's a different approach where, you know, you go and you see a naturopath and your whole life is basically evaluated in the context of whatever ails you at that particular moment. And so it's a much more holistic, I guess is the right word to use, approach, as opposed to saying, oh, here's a list of symptoms, here's a treatment for those symptoms, right? It's very much figuring out the underlying mechanisms and what contributes to those sort of elements.
Absolutely.
But so yeah. I think, you know, an interesting place for us to start is this idea of your body as a natural healer, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does that sort of mean to you in your field?
Oh, that's a great question. So one of the things, you know, if I put the naturopathic hat on, we're taking the history of the person, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and trying to find the origin of what happened. So what was the kind of triggering event that stimulated maybe a condition or the symptoms? And what we believe in our medicine is that if we give the person the right tools, they can heal. They can mm-hmm. come, their body can come back to that balance. They can come back to homeostasis and come back to their being, whatever that might be. And when I say the right tools, I'm not just saying nutrition and herbs. I'm saying nutrition and herbs and homeopathy and physical medicine. So what are the modalities that are pretty broad to help bring that person back to balance?
Right. And I suppose that's why the sort of heading of integrative medicine applies so aptly, is because it takes a very specific individual and sees what's going to work best for them, right, in that context.
Yeah. And it's you know, my personal experience has been that it really requires taking a step back to hear the story, what's said and what's not said, to help support the person on their journey.
Mm-hmm. So what do you mean, what's not said?
Oh, how do I put this into words? sometimes, I guess one of the best examples I have is I use a modality called applied kinesiology, which is a type of muscle testing. And so often patients come in with their list of symptoms, and I'll do my muscle testing, and one of the organs I check are the lungs. And in Chinese medicine, the lungs hold grief and sadness. Mm-hmm. So if I find the lungs are out of balance for the person, my next question is, you know, is there anything you're sad or is there anything you're grieving about? And very often that is the case. If it's not the case, I'm probably dealing with a respiratory issue with a person that they maybe don't feel in their body. So some of it's just listening to that story, because when you're meeting the person for the first time, they're not always comfortable to share all the nitty gritty. And even though we spend an hour with the person when we're meeting with them, it's a lot of time, but it's not enough time all the time to go into all that history. So some of these other things come up as we're listening.
Right. So I guess to a large degree, it's like listening to the body's communication or the signals that the body is giving that might not be sort of consciously spoken, right? Or even known about, I suppose, you know?
Exactly.
And so do you go through a sort of systematic approach of like looking at the different organs or areas or and seeing what comes up?
So I'm going to answer that in two parts. I do and I don't. So I do from the point of view of doing a very thorough, detailed history, which, you know, can take, depends on the person, can take quite a bit of time. Then I do physical exam, and then I do the muscle testing. And so when I'm doing the muscle testing, I sort of ignore everything I heard up until that point, which allows me to find confirmatory evidence of what the person said with their symptoms. Mm. And or I can find things that perhaps they didn't mention or didn't think was important to mention. And then we talk about that as we're going through the rest of the intake.
Right. So it's really, you know, focused on seeing beyond just what the symptoms are. Right.
Absolutely.
It's a much deeper level of connection. And the other thing that I sort of wanted to ask about, which is, you know, earlier you and I had spoken, and one of the areas that you had mentioned that is a very crucial role is this idea of intuition, right? Mm-hmm. About how that relates both for you as the clinician, but also for the person in terms of having some sort of sense of what's going on, even if it's not exactly clear. Right.
Exactly.
How does that kind of play out in this dynamic?
Oh,
it's a big question.
It is a big question because it comes about in different ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it comes about as an intuition on a question to ask. Sometimes it comes about in terms of maybe a homeopathic remedy that I'm thinking about for the person. I just very transparent in terms of like, why is this intuition showing up? I'm not an expert in homeopathy, but I know homeopathic medicine is very powerful when the person has the right remedy. And so that intuition comes in, you know, am I looking at a snake remedy? Am I looking at a milk remedy? And then I go do my research and figure out which remedy in that series might be the best one for the person. Mm-hmm. And then of course I'm muscle testing to confirm that that's a remedy for the person at that time.
Right. So it's about sort of using the communicate, because, you know, intuition itself is complicated phenomenon. And people have lots of ideas about where it comes from, what it means, and its utility, let's say, where sometimes, you know, people argue that, well, intuition's just a subconscious sort of manifestation that's not exactly in words. And so it's still you, but it's coming up, it's in a slightly different way. And then other people argue that it's more of a divine inspiration, let's say. And so it's coming from something else, or in the sort of relational context, it could be the communication that the person is sending. Well, sending is not the right word, but the way that the other person is communicating to you beyond you know, verbal communication. And it's sort of been well established that, you know, verbal communication only accounts for, I mean, a relatively small percentage of all that we communicate to each other, right? Mm-hmm. And you can look at nonverbals and beyond. I mean, you can even go into the neuroscience of the sort of right brain hemisphere synchronization mm-hmm. phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But, and so it's just interesting to see how this sort of plays out in a medical context in terms of, you know, the patient is there with you, or client, I don't know what the terminology you use is. And then, you know, it's sort of your role to get in touch with your own intuition to figure out what's being said to you from wherever it comes from. I mean, to some degree, it's kind of secondary, right?
It absolutely is secondary. And to your point, it is very complicated and not complicated, because in order to have, my experience has been, in order to have that intuition, I have to come as a blank slate. Otherwise, I'm bringing my stuff into the room, and that's, I mean, we're human, so I'm not gonna dismiss the fact that we all have our biases. But as much as possible, I try to come into the room with a blank slate so that I can be available for what's coming. And frankly, sometimes I'm surprised. You know, maybe it's an image that comes and then I ask the person about it that I wasn't expecting to ask, or maybe it's a feeling. Oftentimes it's very common for people is that in our society, people like to hold everything in. Mm-hmm. They hold their emotions in, they hold their thoughts in. And then frankly, in that moment, I'm not getting a lot of information. So I might call that out. Hey, right. Are you the person that holds that information in? And if you're holding it in, how come? Why are we holding this information? Like, we need to, you know, learn to let go a little bit, right? Right. One of the most surprising images I had that came up, and I didn't know this, this is the first meeting with the person, was that there were a lot of, it was like her and all these people, almost dead people, were hanging on to her legs. And in the moment I was a bit shocked. I was like, did I get this right? Like, I don't know. I mean, mine can make up lots of things. And
seems so kind of random.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I said, I'm like, this might sound really off, but I just saw this image. And she's like, well, actually I just had like 5 or 6 people that passed away in the past number of months. And I was like, okay, so let's talk about that.
Yeah. So that grief, dragging you down, or something grief, like
but
that.
Also, in her culture, there's a mourning period, because it was a Native history culture. So there's a mourning period. And so it was really important to honor that mourning period for that person.
So, I mean, yeah, it's always weird. Like, I mean, maybe weird doesn't have the right connotations to it, but it's interesting how, you know, we sort of use imagery to convey things that are quite hard to describe or talk about, right? Even in communication, where somehow you had sort of received this, you know, image, let's say, that seemingly came out of nowhere and understandably was quite, you know, like, what's going on from your perspective? You're like, this is, I don't understand this, but... And yet, you know, you had the courage, or perhaps the trust in your, this sort of the power of this intuition to be able to say, does this mean anything to you? It doesn't mean much to me, but this is what I'm seeing or feeling or hearing or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it sort of presumably opened up this box that you could then explore, you know, with her, right? Mm-hmm. So does it happen a lot, do you find?
It depends on who I'm working with. So if they're a little bit, if they're the type of person that holds a lot of stress in the body, that particular type of scenario is not happening all the time. If the person's a bit more open, then the information's more available.
That's very interesting, because this sort of phenomenon of psychic defenses, of being able to contain our emotions and feelings, while not necessarily the healthiest option in the long term, the fact that it's possible and effective is kind of interesting, right? That people can block you to these messages that they're sending, you know?
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you bring up. Super interesting. I'm just kind of contemplating it because it's like, yeah, there is a psychic block, right? And my sense is that maybe the person's nervous, or maybe they had experiences where it wasn't safe to share.
Yeah. And, you know, for all kinds of reasons. And it's not necessarily a personal thing with you. I mean, the truth is psychic blocks, if we're going to call it that, are often unconscious anyway. You don't even know that you're doing it, right? Yeah. And that's how, you know, there's a good literature on this sort of phenomenon of stress and emotional turmoil being repressed or shut down or, you know, contained and not released in a way that sort of allows that energy to, well, be released. And that causes all sorts of, you know, physiological upsets and things like that. But also, it's just interesting that we are able to, I mean, because presumably it's a defense mechanism, right?
Yes.
I think it's a good way to characterize it, of like, you don't want that feeling of vulnerability for perhaps good reason. You know, maybe life has taught you from when you were a kid that that's not such a good thing. Now, maybe it's the right time to address that and see better ways of being in the world. But up until now, your sort of survival instincts have kicked in and being like, it's not good to be vulnerable with this stuff. So I need to set up a barrier so that, you know, I don't have to confront anyone in that vulnerable state, even when approaching a helping professional, right? And then it's sort of up to you to untangle those bits to sort of really find out what's lying underneath. But so in terms of like how stress is stored in the body, because I think it's an important sort of point, you know, what's your sense of that? Like, How does that kind of happen? What is it, man? How does that manifest for the sort of clientele that you see?
Yeah, so I would say definitely it's a protective mechanism I see that comes up. Whether it's someone trying to hold in their emotions and stress because they have children, or they're a single mom, or they have a super busy life, that can be kind of a scenario that shows up. If there's past trauma, can be another reason why people hold on to stress. If they're unable or unwilling to talk about their feelings because it's uncomfortable, because they haven't had that role modeling in the past. And in terms of how it shows up, I have pretty much seen it show up in almost every system of the body. Whether it's, you know, something that's very obvious that people can relate to is muscle tension, right? Where does someone hold their muscle tension? And a lot of times it's going to be upper back and neck. For other individuals, if it's a GI issue, then you're going to see constipation or diarrhea. It can show up that way as well. For other individuals, you might see them have kind of a chronic illness. So that gets into a whole nother thing. If there's a chronic illness or an autoimmune condition that pops up, which I also believe is a form of stress, of long-term stress that hasn't, you know, found balance in the body. So it kind of depends on the person where that, you know, point of weakness is, or where they're holding their stress.
Mm-hmm. But so what's kind of interesting to me now at this point is to say, you know, okay, what is stress? I mean, I know that that's a very broad and big question, and perhaps there's not an exact answer to it because it sort of manifests itself differently in different situations. But this idea of storing stress, right, in the body, what does that kind of mean to you? What do you make of that?
So two kind of ways to look at it. From a spiritual point of view, someone's either living in the past or they're living in the future, meaning they're not living in the present moment, right? Because in the present moment, there is nothing but the present moment. So we don't have a future and we don't have a past. From the point of view of where these stressors come from, honestly, I think they happen from conception. You know, how is the environment as the fetus is growing, and I think this is an area that is, you know, under researched and doesn't have enough emphasis prior to conception, because there's a lot of, you know, is the mom nervous? Are there things going on in the family that are imprinting? These are imprints because it's programming. And the reason why I talk about it is because by week 4 of the embryology, the nervous system develops. Mm-hmm. And the nervous system, right? That's where we're going to get programs for our stress. How do we handle stress? You know, calm environment, anxiety environment. So it's going to have two different outcomes. So that's part of it. And then we have the pregnancy, and then we have the birth, what happened at birth. Then we have the next 9 months. So some theory, and I'm starting to see this more often, is from conception to that 9 months sets up the stage for 75% of what the person's going to deal with the rest of their life.
Huh.
So it's like, oh, wow.
Right.
So whether that programming that took place invites certain scenarios into their life, whether it's how they deal with life, do they have a calm kind of constitution or anxiety or other ones, that sort of sets the stage. And sometimes, you know, we can go back to those, even if a person's 50 years old, and tag it back to, well, how was your mom? How was the situation? You know, let's look at that. So that stress piece, you know, it's, I think to some extent it's learned. It's learned. And the other aspect is, you know, we're in 2022, and there are so many stresses we don't even see or acknowledge in our daily life that we're having to interpret, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or the news or a situation or a family, you know, conversation. And we're like, oh, we know the cell phone is stressful, but it's like, what about all these other stresses that we don't actually integrate or, you know, process on a daily basis?
Mm-hmm. Like our relationships with people and, you know, what, yeah. But the other part of it is that, let me take a step back. So, I'm interested in this idea of how your sort of physiological makeup and your relationship with your mom, your primary caregiver from infancy, sort of sets the stage for your psychological and physical development, if we're going to make a distinction, which sort of tends to be done because it feels like there's a distinction, although in reality, we're probably just one unit. but nevertheless, for the sake of convenience, it's a fair distinction to make. But I think it's interesting because it's like, a lot of that is also, you know, to a large degree, like how much of it can you control and how much of it is sort of subject to just the nature of the environment that exists at that time, right? And so I sort of bring it up to say, you know, it's not necessarily fair if people hear that and say, oh, well, you know, it's my mom's fault for messing me up in these ways. And it's like, yeah, but even if she was trying, and presumably, let's say all people try their best at any given moment, right?
Yeah.
And it might not have great consequences, but they're not trying to do harm usually.
No.
And so it's worth understanding your makeup so that you can make sense of things, but not in a sort of blamey kind of way.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. It's absolutely not to blame. And I brought it up because, you know, from a holistic point of view and from a consciousness point of view, the aspect of pregnancy and that whole time period that takes place is sort of almost swept under the carpet.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, someone's pregnant and then, you know, they're going to take their multivitamins and the baby's born. It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, if we really want to understand our development, and to your point about the environment, you know, our environment does play an impact on how we were, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Maybe someone's adopted, for example, maybe they're born in Canada and they're adopted in Japan. You know, and it's like, okay, well, they're going to have a different outlook and a different perspective on life than someone who's born in Canada, for example.
Yeah.
Just simply because they're in a different country, never mind all the other stuff that took place.
Yeah, the change right? in relationships and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So it's in no way am I saying it's the mother or the father's fault by any means, but it's something that, you know, when we're looking at the whole person and spirituality and being conscious and those types of things, is something to be aware of.
Yeah. And the developmental sort of process is hugely important. I agree. And it seems counterintuitive from the way we sort of think of things, right? Because we tend to say, well, infants and toddlers and that, well, they don't form memories. So it's not such a big deal, right? Yeah. Which is, I don't agree with. I'm just saying it makes sense to think of it that way because our sort of psychic life exists in the form of memories that we can access primarily in our sort of conscious awareness. I don't know if that's a well-phrased sentence, but I think you get what I mean. Yeah. But it's like, well, yeah, but all of that stuff sort of is grounded in a foundation, mm-hmm. right? Exactly. And so maybe one way to look at it is it's like, well, when you're developing at those early ages, you're given a set of tools that you can use and mm-hmm. a certain set of predispositions or temperament or, I mean, it's quite hard to really even describe properly because it's so complicated, but you sort of, you learn about the world that way, right? Yeah. Maybe that's the best way to think about it is it's, babies are learning how to be in the world. And if the environment and the people that they're with teach them that the world is an unsafe place for whatever reason, then that's your sort of setup from the get-go is mm-hmm. you need to assume the world is dangerous in order to maximize your chance of survival, right? Or mm-hmm. you can have the assumption that the world is generally safe. There are dangers and things like that you need to be aware of, but generally the world is safe and people are good and things are good. And then that's your sort of foundational starting point. Mm-hmm. And so you basically are just learning and, you know, you can see this with babies. I mean, they spend most of their time just looking around, feeling things, tasting things, just learning, right? Yes. And it's all going in and mm-hmm. being processed. And that's why they sleep so much. Well, that's one theory. and so it's just a learning process, even though they don't remember any of it, nor can we access those memories necessarily, but that forms the structure that then evolves into the sort of ways that we think and deal in the world, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and part of it too, you know, just to touch on, you know, why we're not remembering is the brain for a lot of those first couple of years is in the theta, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's sort of a bit of a meditative state to some extent.
Mm. Right? What do you mean, theta?
So there's different brain waves that we have. I don't know all of them, but alpha, beta, theta, delta, I think are the four. And so theta is
gamma,
one of the...
I think. I think there's a fifth one.
Yeah. Maybe, yes.
Yeah.
So when someone's trying to be in meditation, they're not in alpha and beta because alpha and beta are more the thinking. And so the little infants, they're in that theta state. So it's very impressionable, right? If someone's mm-hmm. doing hypnosis, it's impressionable. If someone's meditating, it's impressionable. And so that time period is impressionable.
Right.
Whether they remember it or not, but it creates, you know, like you said, the foundation, the learning of, you know, how do we move forward?
Yeah. And, you know, that's why early childhood trauma is so serious, let's say, or has intense consequences, because it basically, you teach, the child learns at such an early age something that's well beyond its capacity. And, you know, from a neuroscience perspective, I think they talk about, you know, when there's trauma, the brain's ability to regulate sort of shatters to a large degree. And so that's very difficult to handle. And so mm-hmm. we tend to just shut it down or repress it psychologically because you just need to live the next day anyway, right? Mm-hmm. But the consequences mm-hmm. sort of come piling up many years later when you've survived for all this time, but that hasn't gone away. Right. And so presumably trauma comes up quite a bit as well in your practice.
Yeah. It does in different forms. And I've sort of, whenever I say trauma to my patients, I'm like, it can be a big T or a little T.
Yeah.
because, you know, obviously if it's a big T, it's often not, you know, negotiable because it's very clear it's a big T. But if it's a little T, those ones are perceived traumas by the person. So, you know, very loving environment, but for some reason the child didn't feel heard or whatever the case was because of their own makeup at that point, right? So it's a perceived trauma for the person. So yeah, it does come up to different extents and different situations.
That's a good distinction, actually, because I suppose trauma is typically connotated with serious things, you know, violent trauma, sexual trauma, emotional trauma that we would sort of all think of like, oh, you can clearly identify it, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But really, all sorts of little things happen that have monumental impacts on us, despite the fact that it might be a conversation that you had or one interaction with someone that was not violent or, you know, abusive in any way, but it had some sort of major impact on you, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's why something like bullying can be so devastating.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
While not exactly a trauma, or while not necessarily a big T trauma, it can be a little T trauma, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, it's a good point. And also trauma, yeah. And most people probably have some, you know, big T and some small T traumas. Like, I don't know that anyone sort of gets around it.
No. And you know what? I worked with a psychologist at one point out of Ontario, and she said to me, which kind of really put things in perspective, she said, you know, you could have had the perfect childhood and still be sitting in my office.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, right. Because, and then that's where I sort of reflected on it for a while and thought, yeah, it's a perspective, right? It's a perspective of that person. They had the perfect upbringing with all their supposed needs met and still have some psychological stuff that they're working on.
Definitely. Almost, you know, necessarily at some degree, because once, you know, the sort of basic physiological needs are taken care of, well, then it's all psychologically focused, right? Then you have all the time to think and sit and do those kinds of things. If your whole life is occupied by figuring out how are you going to get food or safety for today or tomorrow, potentially, well, that's all you're going to be focusing on, right?
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. And that makes sense. And a lot of people live like that, right? But for those who don't, then you enter into this weird new phase that we kind of have moved into as a society, where there's this big reflective phase of like, you know, who am I? What do, you know, this like, I think it's the self-actualization. I think who called it that? Was it Rogers or Maslow or something like that?
Maslow.
Oh, yeah.
One of those.
Well, Maslow had his hierarchy of needs.
Yes.
I think self-actualization was the pinnacle of that triangle. But yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, it's just to some degree, you know, thinking about it can feel disheartening, right? But
yes,
I think a different perspective on it is probably to have a realistic, optimistic approach, which, you know, sort of ties back into what we were talking about earlier about, well, we have this natural ability to heal ourselves, right? And you just need the right tools, situations, things like that, maybe people to help us do that, right? And that's, and maybe a good example is this use of trauma where, you know, perhaps not in every case, but very successfully, many people have been healed from their traumas.
Yes.
And are in some degree much more empowered and strengthened because of it happening to them. Right. And so that's a sort of different way of approaching it, which I think is probably how you tend to approach it as well.
Yes.
I mean, you kind of have to as a clinician, right? It would be crazy if people came to you and you were like, no, sorry, you're fucked.
Okay? I don't say that.
No. I wouldn't expect you to, but yeah.
Like where I'm sitting, to your point, when someone comes in with stuff like that, it's like, okay, do I have the tools to help them? Do I need to refer them out? Are we referring them to the right person? When they do get referred out, because one of the things that's become kind of apparent to me, and actually sometimes even get teary-eyed over it, is when someone is working with a professional and they're not seeming to get any better, but they didn't end the relationship soon enough.
Mm-hmm. Who didn't?
The client or the patient.
Right.
Right. Like they're hoping for results, and some period of time goes by, and there was no result of any kind. Right. Mm-hmm. And for someone who's in a major trauma, a big T trauma, that's devastating. And for me to hear those stories, it's heart crushing, because one of the things that I think drew me to medicine, or at least helping people, is this, like, if you're going to look at a person holistically, then it's like, why wouldn't we all work together?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't all of the practitioners work together to really support this person in their healing journey?
Yeah.
Right. So just like being that comfort zone for them as they're moving along. So sometimes in that trauma work, it's me saying to the person, you have permission to say no.
Yeah. If it's not right for you.
If it's not right for you.
Yeah.
If it's not right for you, say no. And it's okay, because there's thousands of other practitioners.
Yeah. No, and it's a heartbreaking thing, because, this person had tremendous courage to decide to take a step towards getting better. And they've offered up their soul on a plate in front of this person to be like, can you help me? Mm-hmm. And if we give them the benefit of the doubt, let's say they try according to their way the best that they can. But sometimes that's not right, because for whatever reason, people need different things, or mm-hmm. we need different healers. Even in like the psychology world, it's like, not every therapist is going to work for you. Like, you got to find one that works for you. And it's no problem of either the patient or the therapist. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, that ability to connect at some level. Right. Exactly. And so, it's hard for everyone. And I suppose it's to a large degree the responsibility of the practitioner or the clinician to say, or to make sure that the client is getting the benefit that they can, and say, if this isn't working for you, please tell me, and we can find someone else that maybe can.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Which is not a situation anyone really wants to be in, but it's a real thing that probably happens quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Right? You don't want to be the client, because you've now sort of perhaps gone through this whole big effort that took a lot out of you, and now this person's saying, I can't help you. Mm-hmm. And the practitioner doesn't want to be in that position, because they want to help, obviously. But to be able to acknowledge that and then take, actionable or helpful steps forwards, like, that's important, because then you might eventually find someone who is just right for you and will be able to help you.
Exactly.
Right? It's a hard dynamic for sure. And, that's why people often give up on psychotherapy, because they go to a practitioner, they'll have a couple sessions and they're like, I don't like the whatever something. And then they'll just say, well, then it's not for me. Mm-hmm. Right.
And yes. Yeah. And that's a very good point, Shane, because, I've heard that from people too, in all kinds of professions, naturopathic included, psychology, whichever. It's like, oh, I tried that once and I had a bad experience, so it's not working for me. And I was like, oh, that's heartbreaking, because it's like, maybe that profession could help, but that wasn't a good fit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the worst cases, it was a shitty practitioner,
Yes.
Which does happen too, unfortunately. But
yes.
Nevertheless, here we are. It's sad when that happens, because it's very disheartening to be in that position. And it makes sense why someone would say that. Like, I totally get it, especially from someone who doesn't know any better, right? Like, how would you know? If you're like, oh, well, let's use a different example. Like, oh, well, surely all chiropractors do the same stuff, right?
Right.
They crack your back. They've had the same training. They know what's happening. It's not a correct assumption, but it's an easy one to make if you don't know anything. And yes. So you go to one and they do some stuff and it doesn't work, or it hurts, or something goes not the way you like it. And you're like, well, then all chiropractors must be doing the same thing. And so why should I go see another one? Because it's just going to be the same experience.
Exactly. And
it's just not true, though.
No, it's not true.
Yeah. And no offense to chiropractors. I love chiropractors.
No, I sit in my office and explain that. I mean, I'm not an expert in chiropractic work, but I certainly know that there's many different ways that they can treat. So I'm sitting there, you know, saying, okay, well, there's all these other kinds. Like, how about this option? But yes, to your point, it would be easy to make that assumption.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, that's why conversations like this might be helpful for people. It's to some degree, even if it's not directly applicable, it kind of might give a sense of like, oh, well, maybe I should try someone else, right?
Yes.
Like, I'm still dealing with whatever this problem is. Oh, maybe they'll come to you. That would be good.
That'd be great.
Yeah. But it's just some sort of, you know, hope that can sort of be instilled at that level, right? Mm-hmm. Now, to sort of just take a different, to sort of switch topics a little bit, right? Like, I'm interested how spirituality intersects with naturopathy?
Naturopathy. Oh, I guess it depends on where you're from, because it's anyway.
With this accent, I have free rein to pronounce things, you know? I'm just that's how I pronounce it.
And that's perfect. How does spirituality come in? The way it comes in for me is learning to be present with my patients. Mm-hmm. Meaning, as they're talking, I'm not sitting there thinking of the next thing. I try not to sit there thinking of the next thing to say, because if I am thinking of the next thing to say, I've missed what they've said.
Yeah, you're not listening.
I'm not listening. And I missed the cues at that point. Like, do we need to go into that topic further? So that's one way it shows up for me. Another way that I found it shows up is talking to patients about turning off the mind chatter. So I do a lot of conversation around, like, what is the ego? What does that mean? And we're not talking from a psychological, like the psychology point of view at this time, but it more of like, you know, when is your body your friend and when is your body not your friend? When is your mind your friend and when is your mind not your friend? Mm-hmm. Right? If someone tells me they're sitting up late at night because their mind sounds like a hamster wheel, the mind's not their friend at that point. I need them to sleep. You know, so I sort of rely on the spirituality in terms of my own experience of practicing it, and then bringing that experience to share with my patients to give them hope that there is freedom, to give them hope that there is something else available, that they don't have to be in their suffering.
Mm-hmm. So for you, it's really the spirituality element is really the mindfulness or the presence practicing that comes into it, which is fine, not a criticism. I think it's great. It's important and it's obviously helpful for innumerable number of reasons. And I like that you sort of take on the role of a role model in this case, right? Because it's important, because it's like, would you go see a, you know, I don't know what the right way is, but you want the person who you're going to see for help to demonstrate that level of competence or skill in something, right? You don't want to go see someone who preaches something that they don't practice, is maybe a good way to say it. And it's hugely important to be able to say, well, because that's how we work, right? Is when we see other people being able to do it, we're like, oh, well, then maybe I can do it.
Yeah.
Much more, in a much more visceral way than just hearing about it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Like, probably one of the more difficult things I've I've done on my spiritual journey is facing some of my negative emotions. Because there was a time when, frankly, I hated humanity, which is interesting because I had started medical school at that point, and it was like, well, you want to help people. And I even thought to myself, man, you want to help people and you hate people. Like, how is this going to work? And I can tell you, having faced those dark negative emotions, it's much easier for me to sit with the patient and let them know that it's okay if it comes up. I will sit with you if it comes up and you can get to the other side of it. This doesn't have to be your reality forever.
Right. And that sort of internal conflict is present, right?
Yes. Yes. Because the thing with the negative emotions, and I'm not talking about anxiety because people, they sort of seem to navigate their way through the anxiety. But where there's a difficulty that I see is that if they're approaching anger to rage, that's where they want to shut down. And that's where they start to hold everything in because, you know, if I'm going to approach a rage, I might lose control.
Dangerous.
Right? And people don't want to lose control. And, you know, there's certainly ways to deal with that are very safe, you know, because you can deal with it internally. But the fear is that they're going to lose control in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that anger is really a defense, right?
Yes.
It doesn't feel like it.
Right. So the anger is a defense for fear, actually.
Yeah. Which makes sense, right? It's better to be angry in the face of real danger than it is to be afraid to some degree.
Yeah.
Except when it happens all psychologically, it's confusing to be able to pass those two things out, right?
Yes. Yes. You have, what I have found, you have to sit for a while and actually somehow go underneath the anger to see that there's fear under it. Yeah,
which is a fun journey for all of us. You know, we're like, oh, we're just moving from one, you know, bad feeling to another. But inevitably, that's how you get to resolution.
Yes.
There's no other way around it, unfortunately.
No, there isn't. I haven't found another way. It's to, and this is where the spirituality piece comes in. Can you be present with yourself with that emotion?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because then I tie in the physics, which I just love. So in physics, they have the particle theory. So the moment they tried to observe the location of the particle, it moved. Yeah. And it's like, well, that's brilliant because the moment I observe myself, it has to change.
Yeah.
And it's an incre- like, I'm not going to say it changes overnight. It's an incremental change. But the thing is, the change that takes place over, you know, a longer period, but short relative time is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part I get excited about. It's like, oh yeah, just go through this and you're going to be on this amazing, you know, other side of the island that just blows your mind afterwards. Like, yeah. I know it's really crappy, but there's just other amazing stuff.
Yeah. One step at a time, right?
Exactly.
You can't run a marathon all at once.
No.
But it's true. And it's interesting because, like, you know, your example of how you had this, you know, hatred of humanity, I think that it's a pretty pervasive feeling that people have. And I also understand that it's in context, right? It's not that you hated humanity all the time, all day, every day. It's like, no, because we have all kinds of conflicting thoughts and some of them dominate others. And then it feels like that's the reality. But clearly it wasn't your entire reality because you were also at medical school and had this huge desire to help people, right?
Yes.
And so for you, it was just about navigating that conflict in a sort of healthy way, right?
Yeah.
Without just shutting it down and waiting for it to pop up again at some later point. But I think it's great that you're able to sort of normalize that for people because I think everyone has crazy thoughts, you know?
Absolutely.
All kinds of things. I mean, you know, I doubt there'd be a person who would be willing to share every thought that they've ever had and not be a little bit worried about what other people would think. But the truth is, if we all did that, everyone would see that we're all a little bit crazy. Some maybe a little bit more, but you know, that crazy thoughts happen and that it's okay and that we can handle it. right? And yes. And that's the main point, is that you have to learn how to trust yourself to handle emotions.
Exactly.
Which is very strange that we don't, because it's such a natural part of our being, right?
You know, and it's interesting to say that, because I've been sort of contemplating, like, you know, are the emotions or the way that we handle things, would it be easier or different in another country?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for all Canadians, but, you know, a lot of people have an upbringing, let's say, English, Scottish, Irish, because we have descendants. A lot of Canadians have descendants from there.
Sure.
That very much is, you don't talk about your feelings, right? Yeah. You know, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday about processing grief. Our country is terrible at processing grief. You have 2 days of bereavement and then you better get back to work. And I'm like, yeah. And then the psychology text changed and says you have 6 months. It's like, wait a minute. You know, in other countries, it's 2 years of grieving. In other countries, Latin American countries, it's a Day of the Dead celebration. They're not crying. They're having a party.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I was sitting there thinking, you know, would we process emotions differently in another country? Or is it, you know, more the parental kind of thing? And if we are going to process emotions differently, how do we show up to do that?
Yeah.
You know, and I think to some extent, it's the role model that we have in our life. And then after 18, it's how do we show up for ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Even before then, I would say probably. It's just less, it's not as easy because, you know, you're very much in your parents' house and things like that. But the culture part is you're right. And I think it's a very critical element to it. And it's probably, well, listen, people have spent their lives studying these kinds of things and, you know, yeah. how emotions are differ and how they are the same in different cultures. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think they identified sort of six primary emotions that are cross-cultural. What is it? Joy, anger, fear, disgust, something like that. Okay. That's sadness, four. Yeah. Sadness. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
And what's weird about it, when you look at it, is it's like, well, the primary ones, you can see cross-culture. And we can mm-hmm. actually identify them in other people's face and facial expressions despite massive cultural differences. But what those emotions mean probably is more micro level. Although macro to a large degree as well, because if you're in a particular community or culture or country, it depends on your scale. It's like, this is just how we do things, and that's what you learn, and that's how you deal with it, but it's not necessarily good or not necessarily bad. I mean, there's both. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the case that in all cultures, there's good things and bad things, well, good ways of dealing with it and bad ways of dealing with it, right?
Yeah.
But it is it's a fascinating area mm-hmm. to sort of think about. And, mm-hmm. you know, how do we sort of shape cultural or societal norms to best suit the most amount of people or everyone ideally, but is that really possible? It's, you know, who knows?
Maybe another lifetime.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing is like when there's a homogeneous culture, it's easy to regulate things widespread, but it's also easy for bad things to become equally bad widespread, right?
Sure.
And that's why evolution favors diversity, because then you have lots of options for all kinds of situations. And so diverse cultures are good in that regard as well, for sure.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's a, you know, we're strange creatures. That's for sure. It's very weird to be a human.
Yes.
It's very strange. I've often thought about how, you know, we have this weird relationship with our emotions that doesn't make sense because they're so natural part of our existence, and yet we have these ideas of like, oh, you know, we should be this much emotional or that much emotional, or you know the men and women differ in their emotionality, and while that might be true, it's not necessarily the relevant part. Is how can each person best manage their own situation?
Yes.
right? And that's hard to do. And it's not an easy task, particularly because it's not something that we're taught directly. You know, what school teaches emotional affect regulation? None. You know, why isn't meditation a part of school curriculum from like day one? It's a good question.
Agreed.
But, you know, I guess that's where like parents and things like that have to, for the moment, step up, right? Yeah,
exactly.
And we're definitely moving in that direction, I think. You know, and you can see it even like how in Canada we have like 18 months of maternity leave, or what do they call it? They call it parental leave now, I believe, because it can be taken by both a mother and father separately or together, which is, you know, probably one of the highest in the world. Which is amazing. And so there's all these good things that are happening, but also a long way to go. But anyway, listen, this has been a fantastic conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
What would you like to, where can people find you? You know, if they want to contact you, who can contact you, from which countries? Do you do international stuff? Please promote all your things.
Yes, thank you. So people can find me on social media. So Instagram, Facebook, and sometimes I pop up on TikTok. But I won't say that that's my primary one at this time. One of the things I'd like to share with the audience is that I have a six-week Energized You program where we really delve into setting up the stage in the physical realm. In terms of the body, the environment, hormones, those types of things, where you can really set the foundation for moving forward with a different lifestyle in very easy steps. In that program, there's online modules, and also I meet with people once a week to kind of answer any questions they have and talk about challenges and that such a that thing. So if you're interested in that, please reach out. I believe there's going to be links in the
Absolutely.
Below the podcast. So we'll have the links there for you to reach out. And certainly if you want more of a direct line, you're absolutely welcome to email me and we can set up kind of an empowerment call where we can touch base one-to-one.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Candace Stanek.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Awesome. I hope to speak to you again soon.
Sounds great.
Take care.
We'll be right back.